This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And later this week, we may, quote-unquote may, have some news about the show. Good news, everyone. But if we do have news before next week's episode, we're going to mention it on the Twitter feed before you'll probably hear it mentioned on the show itself next week. If you're not already following at Text Message Pod on Twitter and you're curious about this news, or obviously just curious about midweek technology news anyway, then I would say go and follow that account and you'll be the first to hear and see what the news is. But hopefully this will be exciting to everyone. Ian, given that you know what I'm talking about, do you think that I've given the required amount of sort of anticipation there? Should I have gone further?
It's like those YouTube videos where they always perpetually have an announcement. I've got an announcement, or they're doing a collaboration, or they, you know, do some clickbait. Yes, the news is interesting. It bodes well for the future of this show, and I feel like people will be excited and interested. And also, it's basically what they told us to do.
Yes, indeed. Hundreds of them, in fact. So thank you for that. Keep your eyes, as I said, Text Message Pod on Twitter if you want to see that before next week's programme. Let's start, though, by talking about two things that are happening to British schools. They have a tech angle. Here's the first one. Two schools in the UK are trialling the use of body cams, that is, cameras worn atop the body, if it wasn't obvious, to be worn by teachers to monitor student behaviour and protect them, the teachers, from abuse. Now, this is according to a story I read this week on Wired. The schools in question are remaining anonymous. We don't know which two schools in Britain this is happening within, but the trial has already begun and is set to last for 3 months. Now, there have been reports that violence and disruption in schools has been increasing in recent years. And so, says Wired, the wearable cameras are being trialled as both a means of deterrent to deter bad behaviour and also as an opportunity to record positive learning within the classroom. And I assume to record any negative incidents that may or may not be needed to be reviewed down the line. The footage of said incidents and behaviour will be stored in the cloud, which is similar to how footage recorded from UK police force body cams are stored in the cloud also. And there's about 20,000 police body cams in the use in Britain. Obviously, in Britain as well, we have tons of CCTV systems everywhere. I think we have some of the highest numbers of CCTV per capita of any country in the developed world. And we're now extending this out of the streets and into classrooms, at least as part of a trial. Now, Ian, before I get to my opinions, what are your opinions?
I'm not crazy about it, I've got to say. I mean, I sort of understand. I understand it more with the police because, you know, that they are dealing with violent offenders who are very likely to, you know, try and hit them. And they need to be able to show that they used an appropriate amount of force. With classrooms, I can see the good side of it. I can see why teachers would resist it as well, because if you feel like you're being monitored all the time, you know, it just has that sort of like slightly overbearing attitude to work. And as long as there's no serious worries about a teacher, you know, and their interactions with the students, I don't think it's it doesn't feel great to me.
Now, I mean, it raises a number of questions for me, and you've almost touched on one of them there, which is which teachers and in what circumstances would one of these cameras be required to be used? And obviously, because all this is currently anonymous, we're not going to find anything out until such time this trial ends and a report is generated. But it seems to me to be fairly, I want to say a no-brainer, that you can see these deployed in very difficult schools, you know, possibly inner city schools that have very high population where it's difficult to control a classroom maybe, but that it's not necessarily going to be a teacher's choice to wear this. I'm not sure. There are contractual issues, obviously, I'm sure as well, that it's probably not written in a teacher's contract that they need to wear cameras either. So there would have to be some sort of voluntary participation, I think. But one expert did say that, quote, filming in schools will only occur when it's legitimate, proportionate, and necessary, and that the body cameras being discussed here are not to be used as a surveillance camera. So this is not about surveilling and monitoring specific children. At least that's the interpretation in the two reports that I read.
But I mean, who's going to stop that? Like, at the end of the day, those teachers are going to turn in their body cameras as they leave the building when they finish work, and someone's going to have access to that footage, aren't they? So what's to stop an overzealous head teacher looking through each teacher's footage at the end of the day? I just, there's something about it that just doesn't sit well with me. I can't entirely put my finger on what it is, because like a lot of insidious rules and, you know, and CCTV in general, it is always pitched as keeping us safe by monitoring the bad people. And I don't know. I feel like if you're a bad person and you're out with malicious intent, that you sort of, you would be aware of this and you would take steps to avoid detection. It feels like, you know, we're watching everyone.
But I think this is the merging of two precedents we've seen already, though. We have cameras in schools. Schools have CCTV cameras in them. My school that I grew up in had CCTV cameras before I even left the town that I grew up in to move to London over a decade ago. And we also have, as we noted earlier, cameras on police officers in the street, and we have CCTV. So it doesn't seem like a stretch to think that this is the way it was going anyway, but it will be probably the spring at the earliest before we hear how this trial went and what the next step for that trial is. We will keep our eye on it, and we'll check back when we know more. Well, meanwhile, in the second story we have about tech and schools merging or colliding, kind of like the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy in several billion years' time, cybersecurity lessons, according to the BBC, are going to be given to schoolchildren in England in a bid to find what the story at least says are the experts of the future to defend the UK from attacks. Now, it's hoped 5,700 pupils aged 14 and above will spend up to 4 hours a week on the subject as part of a 5-year pilot to be made available from the next academic year, which starts in September. Now, that was according to the BBC. Another report I read said that it will include classroom and online teaching, so both in school and optional, assuming it's all optional, tuition via an online course, mixing some real-world challenges with actual hands-on experience with some of the issues at hand. Now, this is going to be funded by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. It's going to cost $20 million, or rather $20 million is being provided for these lessons, which are designed to fit around pupils' current courses and exams. So it's very much kind of opt-in. It's not going to form part of the next GCSE curriculum that's mandated. And DCMS is seeking providers to deliver this programme. Bids are closing next month, so we don't know exactly who's going to be responsible for coming up with the lesson plans and the actual tuition. Now, obviously, this seems on the face of it to be a very good idea. Cybersecurity is getting no less relevant. We're going to need experts in the future. But it is something that I felt when I read this story this week had happened before. And I did some very brief Googling, and it didn't take long before I read another story on The Telegraph from 2014 that said at the time there were lessons in cybersecurity to be delivered to school children across the UK in response to growing concerns about a rising skills gap in the industry. That was going to be funded by the Cabinet Office and backed by the NCA, the National Crime Agency. Now, that, of course, was under the previous coalition government. This now is from our present-day Conservative government. So I'm not entirely sure if there'd been any crossover there or how successful the previous one had been, if it was widely rolled out, if at all. But $20 million has been put aside. Bids are closing in a month. It seems like it's something that is actually going to happen, which I think is fantastic. And I really hope that whoever is delivering these courses is going to do so in a way that isn't necessarily sensationalist and actually is going to give people practical skills. They need to know about things like firewalls and stuff like that. And it's kids are going to be much more adept at tackling these than we would have been 10 years ago when we were being taught about how to use Excel.
And if nothing else, we will reach a point where TV drama will be made by people who have had a basic understanding of what a firewall actually is. And they will know that computers don't click when you type, and intrusions don't just show up with a big red box that says firewall intrusion detected, blah, blah, blah. So there'll be an ancillary benefit of this in that people will walk away from school with a vague understanding of computers that will be beneficial. My daughter has just been through Internet Safety Week. I mean, we've seen a lot of this online, but even at 6.5, they're teaching them about, you know, being safe online, which is pretty good.
I didn't know about that. Can you tell me more?
Yes. Basically, they have that. Well, it's really aimed at older kids. But what I think one of the things that the teachers have been encouraging that this younger lot to do is to, I think they were sort of saying, oh, have a week off the internet. Now, my daughter doesn't really have any internet access, so to speak. She would occasionally do, they have some online learning stuff, and she'll be allowed to log into that. But obviously, one of us is always present when that's happening. So she can't wander off onto the wider internet, and it's all quite safely done. But yeah, I think it's just about getting them to think at that age about what the internet is and about some of the dangers.
No, but that's great, being 6 years old, that they can be a part of something like that, that presumably is presented in a way that is accessible and interesting to them and engaging.
And that's the thing. And she came home and said to me, "Oh, Daddy, I'm not going to go on the internet this week. I'm going to have a week off because it's Internet Safety Week." And I just think that is in itself is fascinating to see that. You know, I guess she sees it as like giving up chocolate for Lent or something like that. She just sort of sees it as the internet is a treat, and yeah, but you have to be careful. It's too much of it is not good for you.
It seems like a pretty final solution that, you know, as part of Internet Safety Week, you have a week off the internet, which it's sort of implicit there that being on the internet is inherently dangerous, which is not strictly true.
No, but I also think if you think about it, and if you think about how we use phones and stuff like that on the internet, it is quite easy to become very, very, I don't want to say addicted, because I'm not sure if that's it, but it is kind of like an addiction. You can spend too much time on these things. I think it's great to teach children that you can walk away from it for a week and be fine. And, that might be extrapolating too much from what she came home with. I mean, she's obviously taking her own meaning from the lessons. But, you know, I think it's interesting to get them involved. And the internet didn't exist when I was six. Well, it did, but not in a way that was accessible to me.
If you're a child listening to this of school age in secondary school, maybe ask your teacher about this. Relatedly, I did think there was one consistent theme I noticed when I was researching this story earlier this week, which is that the story on the BBC about this new cybersecurity initiative in schools was illustrated by a shady-looking gentleman in a hoodie doing something that looked like it was out of the script for Minority Report or a screenplay. And then when I was doing the additional research and found that previous report from 2014 on The Telegraph, the stock image associated was another shady-looking person in a hoodie doing something that looked nefarious. And I thought, if we're going to promote these sorts of things to kids, we need a little bit more effort paid by ourselves, the media, but also elsewhere in the world, to just make sure that when we say the word cybersecurity, we're not directly linking this to shady, hoodied teenagers working out of basements. You know, it's not a good image. We don't want to associate the field with that. And I think that needs to be addressed both in and out of the media.
And by educating kids, we'll hopefully avoid that, right?
I hope so. There was a cybersecurity expert called Brian Lord who is quoted in one of the BBC stories. He's actually a former director at GCHQ. And he said that, you know, the scheme itself was going to be an essential initiative to recruiting people into profession, which I agree. But he said, and this is a direct quote, he said, "There is a perception that cybersecurity is all about techno geeks who have long hair, glasses, wear heavy metal t-shirts and drink Red Bull. And first, I thought, that sounds a lot like me. You know, I was wearing a Cannibal Corpse t-shirt at the time, so it did feel a little bit like he was peering through my webcam, and having come from GCHQ, it wouldn't surprise me if he did. But then he went on to say that there are those, and they do an extraordinarily good job. But there is a whole range of other activities that can appeal to a wide cross-section of children, graduates and apprentices, and at the moment they don't know what it is that's on offer. And I thought, well, that's absolutely right, and I just really wish that the editors of the site at the time hadn't illustrated it with a picture that kind of matches his description there. But that's a little inside baseball, or a British sport that we have. But if you have any thoughts on this, if you're a teacher, if you're at a school, you have any ideas or are going to get involved in this, please let us know. podcast@natelangson.com with any thoughts. Well, this week, Ian, I was trying to think of a way of making a joke about Tim Cook, Apple's CEO, heading to the University of Glasgow to collect an honorary doctorate, which he did this week. And the closest I could get was to have the iPhone, you know, the AYE phone. Scots tend to say I a little more than we do in England, and I thought that'd be funny. I couldn't work it into a good joke. So what I thought I'd do instead is just explain the idea and hope that that amused somebody.
Well,
did it work? It's
hard. It's a written gag, right? It works well written down. It doesn't work well spoken. Honestly, I'm going to go with no. It was somewhat of a failure.
That's disappointing. I'll be honest. That's hurt me deep in the feelings. Fortunately, the news will withstand, and we can go on a little bit more to say that he had a fireside chat, a Q&A during his tour, a little mini tour of Britain and other places in Europe, in fact, this week. And Cook had said that Britain will be, quote, just fine after Brexit. He was confident. He said that the firm's intention was to keep investing in the country. This was according to a write-up I saw on v3.co.uk this week. And I did wonder if what he meant was Britain selling Apple products will be just fine after Brexit, given that they have recently increased prices somewhat. But I think he was talking more broadly. One of the things he said is, he said, and you'll see why I'm pairing this story to the previous ones, he said, quote, "We think coding should be required in every classroom in the world if it gets kids a lot more engaged because they are living in a digital world. We're all living in a digital world." Now, he probably wants them to buy iPads to do that. I guess fair enough. That's kind of his thing. But it was a nice set of sentiments, I thought, to hear. I'd like an honorary doctorate one day. I didn't go to university. I have no degree. I'm completely unqualified to do what I do, actually.
Well, no, you're not. You're not unqualified. You're perfectly qualified. You have conflated the idea of going to a building for 3 years, learning about something completely unrelated, and then walking out with a piece of paper. I mean, I went to university, but it had very little impact on what I've ended up doing in terms of, you know, where my career went. So
Thanks, mate. That makes me feel better. You know, I previously was hurt in the feelings on the previous story, and they've been lifted up. They've raised me up.
Honorary doctorates have always struck me as very odd, because if you've the only real reason to go and get a qualification is to at the end of it hopefully have learnt something, and as you know, as you go down the educational system, you get more and more specific learnings. So if you're a doctor, then you go and you get a speciality, and you know, but by the end you're an expert in that field, and there won't be very many of you. But giving out honorary degrees and doctorates and things like that, just I wouldn't want one particularly. I'm sure it's a great honor, and I understand that it forms a part of a university's ability to attract students, but you know, why would you want something you haven't earned?
I suppose it's all about PR, isn't it, really? It's good. It's good PR, getting an honorary doctorate.
That's right, it is. And it PRs the university, and it, you know, and it makes certain people feel good because their contribution has been recognised. I guess it's like a knighthood or something like that. You know, it doesn't in itself mean a great deal. Yeah. But it's
I don't know, actually. I thought this once before, actually, which is that, you know, I mean, I don't live in any illusion that one day I'll have a knighthood. But what I like about the thought of anybody having a knighthood, from a personal experience or feeling rather, is not to actually have one, but to know that I've done something that deserved one.
Yeah,
you know, that's quite a nice thing. You know, it's that would make me feel quite juicy inside. Ian, can I ask you, it's a bit slightly personal question, and no obligation to answer this, of course, it might land you in jail, but have you committed any crimes recently?
I'm just trying to think. I've probably broken the speed limit, to be honest. I mean, because I think most people do that, right?
I don't drive, so I don't know. My assumption is that it's more common than some other crimes. But and for the purposes of introing this story, I thought it'd be worth knowing whether perhaps you have fished without a fishing license.
I can't think of anything more boring than fishing, so no.
Okay. Have you dodged any rail or tram fares?
No. Okay. I'm a big subscriber to the idea of paying for rail fares.
Right. Well, in that case, you are irrelevant as far as this story is concerned, because UK criminals, not Ian Morris, accused of minor offences will soon be able to plead guilty and receive a sentence online. There was a government document released this week that had a very long title I won't bore anybody with, that had a lot of kind of some conclusions based on a survey done with people of the public and legal practitioners and things, that concluded it might be quite a good idea to let people pay for crimes online, but key is they'd have to plead guilty online and then pay an associated fee, the idea being that it freed up judges to do more important jobs rather than sending people to court. And I thought that'd be worth it having a little chat about, Ian.
It's kind of feels like a shakedown. You know when you get those things, sometimes you get like maybe not malware, but like an overlay to a website that says you've been caught looking at porn, it's illegal, you've got to pay the police £1,000 or something like that. And they're hard to get rid of, but it's just an overlay, and if you Alt-F or whatever, it goes away. But if it feels, again, you just feels like you're scaring people into just paying up, right?
Well, this is actually interesting, because this is one of the things that this consultation revealed, which is that one of the major concerns is that there'll be some vulnerable users, and this is particularly those who have maybe learning difficulties, mental health issues, or poor language skills. They might not understand a lot of what they're seeing. They might not understand long-term implications of pleading guilty to something or, you know, accepting a criminal conviction or the standard penalty without arguing it. I mean, the government said they're going to have safeguards in place. They're going to run a trial. A trial will go ahead, and they're going to monitor how this it responds. But you've highlighted that key point.
Well, also, but I think that this is just wide open for abuse, because as soon as you start allowing people to collect fines online without any court process being involved in it, what you're doing is then you're saying, oh, okay, so scammers will then go, oh, you were caught speeding. You were caught doing 40 in a 30 or 35 in a 30. And people will be like, oh, well, I've almost certainly did do that. And then there's a link to a very official looking webpage, and the fine is like, it's a £10 fine or something like that. So, again, it's not enough to really worry you, but you just pay it. And if you do that to enough people, and there are plenty of people in the world who would just go, oh, probably did do it, looks official, I'll just pay it. It's only a tenner, right? You know, there is very little doubt in the public's mind. If they get something online that says go online and pay this fine, they know it's nonsense. So that would be enough of a reason, I think, to not do it.
Well, there's another point that was raised in page 10 of this document. Which I may have in my hand in printed form. In this document, some respondents had suggested that actually allowing this online pay, you know, admission of guilt and associated paying of the fine, if that's the correct sentence, would actually allow people to commit more offences without being subjected to the embarrassment, that was put in quote marks, of being in a dock and sentenced in a public court. So essentially, if they've got lots of money and they don't really care about a fine anyway, they can you know, go and pull a cod out of the river and eat it for free. And if they get caught, they'll just go online and, oh, I'm caught again, curses, you know, type in the details, pay the fine, and then go back out and catch a haddock. You know, or jump off the tram without paying, jump onto a train without paying, catch, I don't know, hake. Do we have hake in our rivers? I have no idea.
I don't know, but we don't have cod or haddock in our rivers. Those are, I believe, saltwater fish, aren't they?
All right, Captain Birdseye. the fact is, they may not allow this for repeat offenders. You know, so if that was an issue, which obviously is an issue, they raised it enough times to be considered an issue, then they could say, well, you were just caught for pulling, insert type of fish here. Fine, you've had that, but now you've been busted for jumping off a tram without paying. You're going to have to go to court for that.
That's very similar to the way that the existing, if you speed, you can sometimes be offered a speed awareness course, but you're only allowed to do one of those every 3 years, and it basically commutes your points to zero, and it costs a little bit more than the fine to go, but it means you don't have any points.
Mm. Well, so in addition to those issues and some other issues raised by people, again, you know, learning difficulties, mental health issues, you know, the government had said that the system will safeguard vulnerable people. I mean, that seems like a no-brainer for them to say.
Well, I mean, of course they're going to say that, aren't they? I mean, they're not going to go, ah, yes, it is going to make it very difficult for vulnerable people, but hey-ho.
Yeah, and it's a trial, but they say it's going to be designed for users, or rather, it's going to be designed to prevent users from pleading guilty without fully understanding. So they're going to have potentially, you know, links to an online chat service where people can type in. They'll have a message that says, you know, call citizens' advice, call a lawyer or a solicitor or something. They're going to try and make it easy. But really, the whole thing that this boils down to is freeing up magistrates, because I don't imagine this is going to cost like huge amounts less to police, so to speak. It's more about allowing magistrates to get on with dealing with more serious crimes, potentially. As such, anyway, just to conclude, the next steps are, apparently the majority of respondents as part of this consultation supported the principle of what they call a statutory standard penalty option for people who do enter an online guilty plea. So they're going to carry out a pilot, extensive piloting, they say. They say it's going to safeguard vulnerable people, as we've discussed. And, you know, they're going to do their best to make it clear. I still think this has a very low likelihood of getting off the ground because, as you say, there are too many foreseeable problems that might allow people to admit guilt where they should. Maybe there were mitigating circumstances that aren't easy to convey over a web service. And if it does become a thing, it's almost certainly going to be simultaneous to the traditional option of paying a fine, in which case, what's the point in having it? Because then you're paying twice and not saving anyone any time or money. However, we'll keep our eye on this for you. I'll keep reading extensive government documentation to find out if there's a story in it. And you can look forward to hearing that in the future on Text Message. That's what you're getting from us. Government documents being read on your behalf. Well, it's been a bit of an intense show so far. We've talked about schools and law and fines and all sorts of things. So we're going to talk about something a lot easier to digest. We're going to talk about the 10 most influential mobile phones. I mentioned to my fiancée Kate earlier that we were going to talk about this, and she said, why? And I said, because I want to. That was literally my justification for including this. I saw a link on The Guardian today, or this week, for a list of 10 influential phones. And I thought, yes, let's discuss that. And of course, you know, who can forget the Motorola MicroTac 9800X, or the Benefon ESC, or the Samsung SPH-M100 Uproar? That was the first mobile phone to have MP3. Support. What else we got? The Sanyo SCP-5300. That was the first camera phone. Or the O2 XDA Flame. That was the first, Ian, you'll love this. You'll love this. This was the first dual-core processor PDA phone in the O2 line.
Wow.
Who could possibly forget those? Probably everybody. Anyway, none of those feature in the list I was looking at. I just thought they had funny names and they had interesting facts associated with them.
Mm.
The Guardian had in its top 10, what did they have here? The Motorola DynaTAC. Now, that was the one that started everything, wasn't it? That was the one that came out in 1984.
Yeah.
Took 10 hours to charge, lasted for about half an hour, cost about £7,000 in today's money. They had the Motorola StarTAC. That was in 1996. That was the flip phone. Obviously, the Nokia Communicators, the Nokia 6210 from 2000, the 3310 in 2000. A few others here. And I thought this would be a great opportunity to get some feedback from our dear and beloved listeners and Twitter followers to tell us some of their favourite phones and for you to write in and give us some descriptions of your favourite phones. Ian, do you want to take us away? What was the first reply we had on the Twitter feed? It was from, who have we got here? Marta. What did Marta say?
Yeah, Marta said the Nokia 3310, which is, let's be honest, going to be a common answer in this, isn't it? Because those early Nokias were really pretty popular and very sturdy. And Martha says it's the only phone I've ever had that survived being dropped in a mosh pit.
Wow.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. That phone is probably still going somewhere.
Almost certainly. Those are the phones where if they got hit by cars, there was more damage to the car.
Yeah.
They were pretty intense. What else do we have here? Paveen, she wrote in. She said it was a Nokia 3210. I mean, that's a predictable one. I have to say I would agree. That's the best phone ever made.
No.
Or more specifically, yes.
Well, but also no. I mean, it
have you considered yes?
Well, I have, but then I settled on no. But what? Let me explain. There were two kinds of people in the world. There were Ericsson people and there were Nokia people. You were very clearly a Nokia person.
Correct.
I started with Motorolas, and when they all broke in the way that Motorolas always did, I ended up with an Ericsson, and they were great.
Hmm. Okay, well, moving on, because I'm standing by my original opinion that 3210 was the best phone ever made. Mm-hmm. Sebastian said the Sony CMD J70 was his absolute favourite. He says he still has it as an emergency phone.
That's good.
Now, the J70 was an interesting one. I had its predecessor, I think. It had a scroll wheel on the left-hand side and was the very first phone I ever had that technically could support pornography. It was dot matrix porn off a WAP site, and I remember that my mobile phone network at the time, it did free... My mother listens to this. Shouldn't really be saying this. But it had free WAP access at the weekends, and you could browse all sorts of stuff.
At the weekends?
That's great.
Amazing. This was obviously... That phone harks back to before Sony merged with Ericsson's mobile division. So that was a pure Sony phone, whereas at the time I was using pure Ericsson phones, like the T10 and the T18.
Yeah.
Great
well, Rhiannon-
phones.
Rhiannon, I mean, the Sony phones were great at the time. They were a strong competitor to the Nokias and Ericssons of the world, but they didn't innovate quite enough.
Didn't really sell either.
Well, that's the other problem. And Panasonic used to sell phones over here as well. I had a Panasonic phone at one point. They were always more popular in Asia.
My friend Nathan started with a Panasonic phone, and then they pulled out of the market, which they did a couple of times before returning and then pulling straight back out again.
Sebastian said, oh no, we just had Sebastian. Rhiannon said, look me in the eye and tell me the 3300 was not the greatest of all time. Although she broke that down to was not the GOAT.
Ah.
The 3300 was definitely one of the most unusually designed. It had a square screen as well, in addition to being oddly shaped.
They had that one that was like an Art Deco lipstick holder, didn't they? It was a long, thin sort of cube of phone. I honestly it was no wonder that Nokia eventually, you know, had to get outside help, because it was quite clearly full of bonkers people.
Well, we had another vote for a Sony here from Christopher, who said I have most affection for my Sony CMD Z7. Obviously no comparison to a smartphone or even a feature phone, but so well resolved is what he said. And I think the Z7 might have been... Oh, no, that was the flippy one. The Z7 was the flippy Sony back in the day. So that was from the same line. Also had a scroll wheel on the left-hand side of it. Same line as the J70 and the one that I had, which I can't remember what model that was. Ian, who else do we have?
Cam Bunton, works at Pocket, another tech journalist, obviously, has very fond memories of the BlackBerry Pearl 8110. I mean, the BlackBerry's... really were very much loved, weren't they? Especially pre-smartphones, because obviously you've got, messaging, BlackBerry Messenger, which enabled you to stay in touch with your friends without really paying a fortune for it. I was talking to my hairdresser about this. She was saying that her first sort of smartphone was a BlackBerry. And I said, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. They sold really well with young people and, like, businessmen. It's a very funny pairing, isn't it?
Yeah, plus the batteries lasted for ages.
But that
so
is true.
That was also handy. And we had a few others here, I think. I mean, we had a vote. Ruben said the Nokia E71 and E72, they were special. They were excellent phones. A lot of people use those as car phones, I think. And then Ian Williams said the Sony Ericsson P800 all the way. A brilliant smartphone way ahead of its time.
That was a phone, wasn't it? That really was.
A favourite of many, I believe.
It's so expensive, though. I mean, if you were buying your own, I think it was... I seem to remember it was like 600 or something quid. Or maybe it was even 800 quid. Maybe that's where the model number came from. But it was expensive.
Maybe. And then just as we've been recording, Emma tweeted to us and said that her first phone was the T18. Now, I think that was an Ericsson. She didn't say Ericsson, wasn't it?
Yes, I had a T18.
Emma said that she thought this was so cool, having a vibrate function. while all my friends had 3210s. Now, the 3210, I believe, in a later edition got a vibrating battery, but it was really the 3310 that brought in the vibrating. That's off the top of my head. I may have made that up, but I think that might have been right. Well, maybe it was a third-party battery.
Yeah, because so Nokia's had vibrating batteries, didn't they? Motorola invented Vibracool, which was in the phone, I think that's right. And then Nokia got around maybe some patent issue by putting it in the battery. And then everyone else just, I don't know, waited for the patent to expire with Motorola and then just did their own thing. But the T18, I got that phone. I'd come off a StarTAC, one of the last generation of StarTACs, I think. And it had broken and I had insurance with my carrier at the time. So I sent it back and they said, well, we don't carry this phone anymore, we'll have to just send you something else. And I had no idea what they sent me, and they sent me an Ericsson, and I was kind of annoyed by it at the time, but then I started using it and it was just fantastic. And from that point on, I didn't move away from Ericsson until they got bought by Sony and it all sort of fell apart.
If you had a favourite phone that was not listed in the several responses we had from listeners this afternoon, then you can tell us those for maybe next week if we get some really creative explanations for why your phone was brilliant. Maybe we'll return to this topic next week. podcast@natelangson.com. Go nuts, everybody. Go nuts. If you've got pictures, send them in too. We'll put them on the blog, perhaps. Maybe you're using one in a compromising circumstance that could amuse me and Ian. That would be great. And in the meantime, let us know on Twitter if you prefer, @textmessagepod. That's where everyone else just sent us theirs. You can too. Let's check in with Tom Merritt on Daily Tech News Show and see what's been going on this week in his wider world of global tech.
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week on Daily Tech News Show, we discussed what the US FCC is up to with zero rating, shared tips for staying safe on the internet, explained what you can get from 5G services when they arrive. It's all about capacity, not just speed. Discussed the NBA's upcoming video game basketball league and talked about whether high-end smartphones are worth the money anymore. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you guys.
Well, Ian, it's that time again. We're at the end. It's been a pleasure, mate.
It has been good, hasn't it?
Don't forget, listeners, that if you want to stay ahead of maybe some big news coming next week, follow us on @textmessagepod, and you can be the first to hear about maybe what we're doing with the show. And otherwise, you'll just hear about it in regular audio form next week. Ian, until then, I think it's time to say goodbye, I think, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's the word that people generally use to bid each other adieu.
Marvellous.
Oh yeah, bye. And then after that, I forgot to say it. Bye!
I'm definitely going to have to put the longer version of that stuff about Captain Birdseye at the end of the show.
That was very amusing. All right, Captain Birdseye. That really did give me a good chuckle, that. Aren't they?
All right, Captain Birdseye. This is a tech show.
Oh, dear. Captain Birdseye. Oh, that's amazing.
Oh. Listen, I have a fondness for Alphabyte. You know, I went around to Andy's house the other night. And he'd done his online shop from Morrison's and it arrived when I was there. And he pulled out a giant bag of potato Alphabites. He said, these are just for you because I know you like Alphabites when you come round here. Which
awesome.
I thought was quite sweet.
Oh, that's very cool.
Well.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.